Oh, I love that. That was so beautiful. That piece by Stephen Seligman, whom I met in Mexico, I did some work in Ajijic with expats, never fails to knock me out. I love that piece. Thank you, Stephen, wherever you are. And he gave me his permission to use it. I came today to think and feel with you about writing memoir. So let me begin by setting some terms of mutual understanding, which is not the same as flinging down commandments from some expert's mountain, but some conversation about memoir. What is it? What isn't it? And how the heck do you pronounce it? I read somewhere that if you don't pronounce it memoir, you'll never get it published outside your family. I say memoir, and I offer as an example a piece I published inside my family of writers early in the life of Women Writing for a Change. We had just started programs for girls, and I asked the adult women writers to write a memory from their girlhood, and this is what came for me. Ironically, the first place I remember feeling the power and pleasure of my voice was the Roman Catholic Church of my childhood, not the whole Catholic and apostolic, not to mention medieval, patriarchal, and misogynistic church, but one small parish in the midst of it, St. Joseph's in Crestline, Ohio. Our pastor, Father Frelich, was an aquiline-nosed intellectual, Croatian, my father speculated. His erudite homilies on scripture were greeted with thinly disguised impatience by the nodding, wristwatch-checking parishioners. Perhaps his insistence on not one but two high masses daily, every day of the week and Saturday, was a way of protesting his long tenure in this anti-intellectual backwater. Whatever the reason, Father's generosity or grandiosity, depending on your point of view, strained the resources of our small, indifferent parish. We did not even have a choir in those days, and an organist only when school was in session and the sisters were in residence. As a result of this and the fact that I was known to have had piano lessons, I was chosen to play the organ for both high masses, the 6:45 and the 8:15, when the music nun returned to the mother house for the summer months. I was paid $5 per week for my services, five single-dollar bills in a slim brown envelope dispensed solemnly by Father Frelich each Saturday after the 8:15 Mass. Payday. Every summer morning for 7 years, I jumped out of bed at 6:15, threw on an odd assortment of clothing, and rode my bike 8 blocks from our small house on the edge of town to the imposing granite church on Toman Street, almost downtown, if a town of 4,000 can be said to have a downtown. Minutes before Father was to process into the sanctuary, I dash up the steps, pull open the heavy door, and slip inside the dark church. Tiptoeing through the vestibule and up the creaky steps to the choir loft slowed me down, but I had it timed so that I had minutes, maybe two, to push any number of buttons and stops on the huge organ, and then, as it hummed to life, to select my music for the day. Now, this was when it was all in Latin, too, I might add. I had no idea what I was doing. And I didn't know how to play the organ, even. I was the choir and the organist, the soloist and her accompanist. High in the handsomely carved loft, invisible to the few mass-goers below, I was fearless. I opened my mouth, and my voice flew out of me like a freed bird, seemed to carry my soul out of me into the whole shadowy, resonant body of the church. My girl's voice, suppressed in all other places, drifted up to the wedding cake ceiling and fell to the marble floors, bounced off the confessionals, and trespassed into the sanctuary itself, where the only women's voices I had ever heard were those of brides whispering vows or members of the Altar and Rosary Society whispering as they dusted and polished. Whether I had a good voice or not was somehow, incredibly, not of concern. The old people who attended those masses told my mother, "It's like listening to an angel." But they were kind and hard of hearing. I look back, and remembering what modulations came later, I marvel at the memory of the full right feel of my voice welcomed into space, the bright animal aliveness of breath, tongue, teeth, words, round here, thinning to a tremble there. It was joy, unselfconscious pleasure, perhaps my only, certainly my purest memory of it. Memoir falls under the umbrella of autobiography, that is, self-writing life. Autobiography has the self writing about herself in a journal, in letters, in a diary, a daily log, in poems, or personal essays. I concur with the late essayist and poet Donald Murray, who observed that all writing is autobiographical, that even a made world, a fiction quite aside from the author's lived world, as far, for instance, as Mars was from Ray Bradbury's real life in Waukegan, Illinois, nonetheless tells us much about Bradbury, about his dreams, his relationships, and his 1950s United States ethos as well. Memoir might be characterized more by what is left out of a life telling than by the comprehensive blow-by-blow autobiography which begins, "I was born," and carries the reader, if he stays along for the too long ride, through every decade of the author's life. There's a story about Russell Baker, already a successful novelist, who, approaching the challenge of memoir, sent his editor 400 pages. Said editor wrote back, quote, "This is typing, not writing," unquote. Yikes. Apparently, their relationship was such that Banks saw his editor's point, but he didn't throw the pages away. Rather, he used them as compost for the story he finally wrote as Growing Up, which focuses mostly on his relationship with his mother. Growing Up won a Pulitzer Prize. The Baker anecdote describes what I call an arc of life writing and helps us to explore the how do you write memoir questions. Spilling stories in any order onto pages is life writing, autobiography, good and sufficient unto itself. But the art of memoir begins if and when you decide to survey the whole for pieces that carry the most energy. Sometimes, like Baker, you need someone to help you see those pieces, as the most enlightened of us are understandably attached to our memories. Arranging the stories into an assemblage that resonates part to part and becomes a beautiful whole completes the broadest description of how to write memoir. Of course, this completion launches other processes, if you choose to continue, tweaking, fine-tuning, proofreading, and consideration of whether, how, and where you will publish. Lightly considering ethical questions about how to write stories that involve others. And I say lightly because the stories can die in your throat if you're really nervous about other people's versions of what happened that involves all of you. Annie Lamott wrote something, I think this is how she said it. If people were worried about what you're going to say about them, maybe they should have treated you better. I kind of like that. I'm under the influence right now of reading Pat Conroy's latest book, which is straight-up memoir called The Death of Santini. You may know his work, Lords of Discipline, Prince of Tides, and whoa, it's very intense. But he's bringing this out after both his parents were dead. Circling back to what is memoir, now that we have had a little how, memoir usually answers the questions what happened and what did it mean, and why and whom does it feel important to tell. The first person it's important to tell memoir to, which begins us on the why thread, is the memoirist himself or herself. In 1989, I heard William Zinsser, that you might say the dean of memoir writing, give a talk, and his words stayed with me until now. He said, it's not so much about getting old that's difficult. It's getting old without things adding up. Really like that. Thus, my take on memoir writing is as an ecological process. Each one of us is writing ourselves more conscious and more whole, and therefore the fabric of which we are a part becomes more whole and healed. I have the thought that in writing honest, non-self-serving, non-egotistical memoir, we are not dumping toxic life crap, to be inelegant about it, onto our descendants. When Zinsser said adding up, I take the meaning that a memoir is not the end-all and be-all summation of a life, but adding stories one by one, like beads on a thread. The value of these necklaces of stories is beyond, far beyond, that of the material baubles of or great literary artifacts you or I might leave behind. Ecologically speaking, we are living on a planet in need of way less stuff, way fewer commercialized or commoditized stories that will make someone a celebrity, and way, way more consciousness. We know ourselves and one another through language, languages, plural, to be sure, dance and iconography and music, but here I speak of lives written in words as the most portable, the least abstract, the most transparent way to leave energy trails of consciousness behind. I have a small cautionary list. Do not send pieces out into the world too quickly. Do not send pieces to anyone who will offer critique, advice, or alternative stories. Do not seek approval. I live every day with the longing to have known my people, my father and mother especially, as they might have narrated themselves to themselves had they believed their lives were of enough importance. And therefore to me, had they left written stories, even one or two, for me to find. The day of my mother's funeral, my father dispatched me, the oldest and the only daughter, to clear their bedroom of any vestiges of her. He said because he loved her. He said he could not bear to be reminded of her absence by the presence of her things. Upon an earlier time, I had found in my mother's dresser drawer, when she sent me to fetch a handkerchief for her, a letter. I was probably 12. It was a handwritten one from a Reverend Monsignor Hoot to my mother, assuring her that her marriage to my father was valid and she could receive the sacraments because Dad's first marriage had been non-Catholic to non-Catholic and therefore not a real marriage in the eyes of the Church. Finding the letter was one of those moments in which the world shifts into new focus, as someone has turned the dial of a kaleidoscope and a new pattern had emerged. I did not know my father had been married before. This was not a traumatic discovery leading me to mistrust my parents. No, this is not that story. It was more like seeing the painting under the painting, if you will, the pentimento. Writing this scrap of memoir today, I see my own vocation in that symbol of pentimento, the passion for meanings and stories that lie underneath the official overlay, the hegemony, the opinions and literature and laws of the great and powerful. Officially handed down, monolithic meanings are all well and good to rally others to build pyramids and cathedrals, modern institutions, systems, and hospitals, or to go to war to protect the tribe. However, the epical necessity of now is to both uncover the ones papered and painted over or cemented over, and to go forward, encouraging depth, breadth, and diversity of stories to nourish culture and nature in crisis. Back to my 12-year-old discovery. When I returned a few days later to check my memory of what I had read in Monsignor Hoot's letter was gone. On the day I was 12, and again on the day when I was 35, removing my mother's precious few things from that drawer, there was nothing written down to tell the story of who my mother was before and while she was my mother. And she told very few, almost no stories about herself. What I know came mostly from the scraps others told about her. My father told more stories, but did not write down his own view of things, though he was a very literate and word-loving man. My father even told my mother's stories, now that I think of it. The few that I know about her life before she met and married him were told by him. My father owned more of the world, enough to tell more stories than my mother, because he was male, because his family had been in the U.S. for much longer than my mother's first-generation Southern Italian orphan status. My dad told stories about hunting and fishing and coal mining and railroading, and some few, very few stories about his service as a bomber pilot in World War II, all subject matter deemed worthy and worthwhile and of interest in the canon. All the written artifacts, the commendations, the flight logs, the scraps, the medals, even the letter to my mother from Father Hoot, were written by some superior taking their measure, defining their worth, giving them permission. And this is why I have two big stories to tell, ones I tell in my words and in my life. One, I do not accept anyone's definition of me. Two, in the world I want to see and work toward, every human being has the right to be the subject, not the object, of his life. As an elder, as a writer of memoir or anything, I am thoroughly aligned with making meanings plural, telling truths plural, which are both the same as yours, and also voicing some aspect of the whole that can only come through me. I heard the cosmologist Brian Swim speak of how it changes everything to understand, for instance, that the cactus, that this cactus, is the divine speaking as cactus. That salmon, when labeled resources, exist only to be eaten, and not also as salmon speaking the divine. I don't know that guy, but I just love him at a distance. Just a little bit more about intention. I care too much about the transformative power of the word to write anything, my life or other, as legacy. I've come to despise that word as I hear it constantly used in regard to this or that great man or great woman, politician, president, and his legacy. And I want to scream. Designing your legacy as an artifact of your ego is so not helping those that you are here to serve, not impress us with your genius. And so of writing memoir. I write of the past and the present becoming moment by moment the past as a tool of becoming more conscious and more alive. My words are bridges as I cross, as I continue more deeply into the mystery. I intend my meanings to enrich your meanings, not obliterate them. I have nothing to live up to. I have everything to live into. I am passing love along.